This is Broken Vessel Conversations with Dr. Dina Zoe Beluigi. I have a visiting researcher here with me, Dr. Grace Idahosa, and I thought it would be a great opportunity for us to record, in a sense, some of the conversations we've been having over the past 9 days informally while we've been working in my office and occasionally at my home and once or twice in a coffee shop, and to record it so that we have it for ourselves and we have it for others who are interested in some of the areas that continue to perplex us. So thank you, Grace, for partaking in this interview.
Thank you. Thank you, Dina, for the normal cheese.
I think Dina's perfectly fine. this is going to be quite informal, I think, Grace. Otherwise, we're not gonna relax, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I've posed four sorts of questions to Grace, very, very loosely, but I think our conversation may take a different route as we go. The first one is really, I guess, the most important one, because it's what's brought us together. And I think hopefully will lead us into many interesting research projects. And that is the issue of agency, which is a strange, complex notion that we are trying to get our heads around. And I guess my first question is, what do you think it was that drew you to study this question of agency?
Okay, thank you, Dina. I was doing a course on feminism, and I had to read Saba Mahmood's book. It was the first paper on the Islamic revival, and then I went ahead to read the book on politics of piety. And there, I think she was basically making the argument that we should understand, and that was the book was in relation to agency. And she was making the argument that we should kind of move away from liberal understandings of agency in terms of resistance. And we should look at it as, understand it as a choice. And she used the argument of the Muslim woman who has chosen to adopt piety as her choice and as agency, rather than looking at it as a form of oppression or being co-opted into a particular hegemonic discourse or religious discourse. Anyways, and
go for it.
Something just didn't sit well with me about that idea, that argument, coming from a Christian background that was very conservative and constraining for me growing up. The idea that the choice not to, for example, wear earrings and obey the laws and the rules of the church, even though they are not really substantiated or backed up by the Bible, as essentially agency. So for a long time, that notion disturbed me, and I just finished my master's then. I was moving on to my PhD, and that kind of put me on the path of agency, because I wanted to kind of understand the whole distinction between choice and the way structures kind of determine our actions and influence our decisions. That's how I came onto agency and understanding agency.
Yeah, and it's taken you through 2 postgraduate degrees, and a research career that has taken you from one South African university, the one that's currently known as Rhodes, and to another one, University of Johannesburg, where you're currently at a center to do with social change. Your studies, though, have really veered into looking at the context particularly of higher education. What do you think the issue of agency brings to the studies of higher education?
I think in South Africa particularly, it's relevant because of the context, the context of apartheid and the transition to democracy and the kind of imperative to transform universities. And largely the focus on transformation has been policy based. In recent years, scholars have been arguing for a shift, not just looking at policy, but also looking at individuals that have to enact those policies, and that a large part of the transformation process has to do with their mindset, their understanding of transformation, and them seeing the need basically to affect or enact those policies and then implement those policies. And so my research basically was looking at how those individuals will have the agency to affect those policies, because my understanding was that apart from just having the mindset, part of it would be having the conviction and the interest in affecting those change. But it's not possible to just have the interest in affecting those change. Those, our interests, our mindsets, our convictions are affected by the social world and social reality. So my research was trying to understand how individuals negotiate that terrain between the structural limitations and also the personal motivations to affect change within higher education. Because at higher education is just not understood as a social good in itself, in the sense of contributing to the development of the society. For it to do that, it has to also transform itself. It has to change the way it interacts with the way the individuals within the university interact with themselves, for it to affect the society.
In my own mind, I link that to the idea of form and content, which is a very humanities notion, but the content of what the university does in the world is very much affected by the form itself that it itself takes, the way that it literally practices and embodies those values and ideas that it spews out. I really like the title. I can't quite remember the exact thing. You probably would know it since it's your paper, but the cruise.
There's some refusing, losing, cruising, and using.
Yeah, those lovely verbs.
Yeah.
Around how women, it was particularly women,
yes, right? First generation women.
First generation academia, women.
Yeah.
And their negotiations. That and those verbs are lovely for the sense of it's not a simple unnuanced thing. There's a whole lot of choices being made. But it's not as if the choices are completely autonomous either. They're happening in relation to a whole lot of actors and conditions around those women.
Yes.
That are, yeah.
Yeah. Basically, that was just the paper was just showing the complexity of marginality and individuals' relationships with structures, where sometimes they have to compromise in order to get something they want, and sometimes they have to kind of enforce their own will. And I think that paper was more, I mean, in the broader scheme of things, I think I had a thing for making choices and free will and all these things. But that paper was basically looking at how women within that context kind of negotiate their terrain, because they don't have the social and the cultural capital to be able to know what to do and to know how to create networks and how to basically succeed. And the research was essentially looking at how they were able to negotiate their terrain. And so we came up with these four constructs of losing, using, sometimes cruising, or excelling in academia, and sometimes kind of rejecting or refusing some of the discourses within academia. And those four constructs were kind of related to Robert Parks' idea of the marginal man.
He wrote talk a little bit about it, because our listeners may not
okay, be that familiar. I read the paper years ago. But basically, I think he talks about, I can't remember the title, but it has to, something had to do with I can't remember, The Marginal Man.
Mm.
And basically the paper was looking at how somebody who leaves his culture and moves into a new culture kind of relates. So sometimes he assimilates the culture, sometimes he rejects that culture, and sometimes he returns back to his own culture. And I can't remember the fourth construct. So basically that was right. Kind of linked to his Robert Park's construction of the marginal man and how he interacts with the new culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Relevant to some of the discussions that we've been having this last week about how, in a sense, what we imagine some of our participants will be doing as they negotiate different structures.
Yeah.
So now I'm wanting to ask you, what areas do you think are still ripe for research for those who are looking at higher education or at agency perhaps more broadly in a transforming or transitional context? What things are still, and I'm not asking for sort of broading things, I mean, people can look to make up their own decisions about broad ideas of what research should be done. What do you think is still hot, important, or perplexing, or really interesting?
Okay. I think one big one would be the, in relation to agency and transformation in higher education, would be how to distinguish between those who choose to enact or to enact transformation or to implement those processes as opposed to those who want to maintain things. What are the structural and individual factors that kind of contributes to that, and how does it affect their interest? Because interest emerges as central in agency and also wanting to take action and effect change. So what distinguishes those, the individual who decides to take action and the individual who doesn't, in relation to transformation within the university?
It's an interesting one, and I'm making you digress a little bit. We had a conversation this morning with a colleague here at Queen's, Professor Brewer, who's part of the George Mitchell Institute, and he was talking about his research, if you remember, that he did years ago on the transformation process within the police.
Yeah.
And he was talking about middle management, which is something we're wanting to research in higher education, but he was talking about it in relation to the police and saying that they played such a crucial role in Northern Ireland because it was in their interests to affect the policies and see change because they wanted to go up further along the ladder.
Yeah.
And I remember at that point you made a comment, but we didn't have time within there to follow it up. And both of us looked at each other and raised our eyebrows. Mm-hmm. I think I understood what you were wanting to say. What I thought you were wanting to say is, yes, but it's more complicated in the South African context because many people who are now in middle management positions do not have that self-interest to motivate themselves. In fact, when they are implementing transformation policies, it may be very much against their self-interest. It may mean they do not progress, and that them staying in their position or even being demoted is sort of happening on their back in a sense.
I was trying to say how the a complex number of factors like your race, your class, their access to resources, which is also affected by those factors at that particular point in time, may not put them in the position where they would want to effect change, or may not endow them with that interest in affecting change within the university. So how to balance that in the whole transformation process, and how you analyze the transformation process within higher education in South Africa. I'm trying to remember the point I was trying to make there.
I imagine, okay, so now you've been much more inclusive in the way that you've spoken about it. So I'm imagining that you're also talking about, when you're talking about people not having access to resources. So the sort of usual example would be maybe somebody who has a first generation status, or whatever, and then they don't, they may, there's sometimes an assumption that they might, may not have a certain capital to exercise power or authority or to get to certain resources.
Yeah.
But I was thinking more, which may sound a bit more sinister, but of, let's say we're talking about South Africa and we're talking about historically white universities. Mm. Maybe you have people who have been, have gotten to a mid-management position who want to go higher, but maybe they're white. And the university has not addressed the equity policy, and so there's a very slim chance that they would be promoted.
Yeah.
And so their self-interest in terms of their personal motivation is lessened.
Yeah, so in that instance, their race and their gender might not give them the motivation to affect change. They might want to preserve things the way they are or reproduce the current power structures within the university because they know that at the end of the day,
there's more to benefit.
Yeah. But interestingly, the current research on agency kind of argues for that, that self-interest does kind of motivate people to take action to transform or reproduce a particular structure. But there are those who, despite their race and their gender and all these factors that might position them as less interested in the transformation process, who do take action. And a part of my doctoral research was trying to understand why they do that. I don't know if you want me to talk about
that. That would be well, let's.
Yeah, okay. And a part of my research was kind of trying to understand that. And I think my conclusion there was that as a result of their critical engagement with the context, with their students, with other staff members who are from marginalized group, they come to understand and empathize with the with those and understand the need to effect change, and that kind of leads to a shift in their consciousness. So the critical engagement and shift in consciousness kind of positions them as kind of interested in the transformation process. So it kind of shifts their, I don't know if it's their self-interest. Some will argue that it's not possible for self-interest to shift because their objective, they're fixed. But my argument was that the kind of the process of engagement and coming to consciousness kind of enables them to see and then take action to effect change. So sometimes the individual social position, like their race, their gender, their class, might position them as opposed to the transformation process. But on the other hand, critical engagement, reflexivity, and consciousness does kind of act as a
fight against those easy locatings of themselves in some way. Something, I mean, the self-interest issue is really interesting. With my research the project that I engaged with in collaboration with Dr. Gladwin Tundlano, looking at the critical race stuff on self-interest and higher education, and it was, I mean, it's just so stingingly like harsh. It really, really is. But I can't help but think that in some ways there is hope, in a sense, for South African higher education. And maybe it's naive speaking about this, but there are so many ways of conceiving of the self that don't have to be trapped within a very Western paradigm of the individual and their social mobility to and career advancement. That there's a possibility that self, when you expand your notion of self, then self-interest in terms of the community of South Africa and the changes in the larger country, it changes your sense. It may not be in the interest of your white skin or your gender or whatever, but it, there may be a sense that you're contributing to the larger sense of your country and the greater good that you've bought into. And I guess, in a way, academic identity is a complicated thing. Because you can be truly committed to growth in your discipline and in your knowledge, or truly committed to growth in higher education that is beyond your own family or your own, but that, I mean, that is really like hope with a capital H, you know?
Yeah. I mean, and that would essentially define the academic who, or the white male academic who decides to take actions that might one day deprive him of his own position, because it's a sense of moving beyond advancing his discipline and advancing his own research to the greater good, if there's anything like that, or to advancing the development of the university and society at large. And I think one of my participants described it as subjecting your own self, your own position, to the same critical scrutiny as you will subject the paper or your own research or your own discipline, the way you teach your students, for instance. Yeah, kind of subjecting your own self, your own position within the university to that. And it is that kind of the critical engagement that I was talking about that provides the platform or opens up the space for the individual to change his or her mindset. Yeah.
I mean, I'm just thinking, and this is slightly off the topic of our research in a way, but there's so much that's happening in the world at the moment that is against a sense of not doing things for your own self-interest. This morning I read an article on Theresa May speaking about the aid to Africa, you know, the whole continent. And she's speaking at, she's going to be engaging in three places across the continent, and the first one in Cape Town. And she's going to be emphasizing that the aid that they're going to be giving has to be in the interests of the UK too. And I thought it is so interesting. There's such a sense of a return to, I will give you something, but something needs to come back. That what is trying, the sort of promise of transformation is that you go bigger than yourself, is that you do more.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's just not the current ethos of what's happening in the political space across the world.
Yeah. I think the way Europe and the West have kind of interacted with countries in Africa has always been to their benefit, not necessarily to the benefit of African countries. I mean, yes, you see, I don't want to go into politics because then it become very controversial.
Okay. Yeah. Should we just stop at this point?
Okay. No, but I'll just say, yeah, the way in which politics have basically always been is that we always act in our self-interest. And even if there is some kind of aid that's been given to a country or an individual, you know that invariably the giver or the benefactor is always benefiting more than that.
I don't know, we might have to delete this, but a little bit of what we touched in the conversations this morning about the what's known as the negotiated revolution in South Africa, where Mandela and everybody sitting around the table were, some say willingly, other people say coerced, to commit to change in the country, but with the purse being held by the West, and making South Africa commit to capitalism that has really catapulted the country into some very, very difficult terrain, particularly for their reconstruction and development sides.
Yeah, and that's been the narrative if you move from country to country in Africa. The relationship has always been beneficial, more beneficial to the West. And not even just more beneficial, it's always been detrimental to the development in these African countries. Yeah, in just the structural adjustment program in Nigeria, for instance.
Are you going to end it there? Okay. All right.
I think I'm going to end it there because...
going to get into hot waters. Okay. The last question I wanted to ask, since really we're together to bridge connections between us and to hopefully strengthen both of our work, right? And I think certainly for myself, those connections that I've made with different people and in different projects have extended me, you know. What sort of projects or what sort of researchers would you like to engage with if you had a wish list? Not necessarily specific people, but... And maybe if there are listeners out there that are wanting or interested in doing certain projects or whatever, what would you like to be involved in going forward?
I think this ties in because I realized that I didn't mention my second point on research that needs to be done on agency and transformation. And right. This will also fall under that, apart from the whole understanding the distinction between those who do and do not take action. Also looking at the gendered nature of the transformation process and how the female bodies kind of enact transformation and also the way in which their transformation actions, decisions are received and resisted within academia, within the university space. That's certainly an area that I would like to explore. Apart from that, increasingly, I have been looking at doing research on decolonization. And since I've done a bit of work on transformation, kind of drawing a distinction between them or similarity, to look for similarities and differences between between the two. I think, yeah, and broadly, my research interest has always been on gender, but not with a focus on women, but on also women and men and the nuances within that, will I say relationship?
Dynamics.
Dynamics,
I don't know.
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Well, thank you for talking. Yeah. It was actually really hopefully. Nice. I mean, we've been running around doing little bits of pieces of paper and stuff like that, but actually it's nice to just sit and chat.
Hopefully I said something useful and meaningful.
You did. You did. Let's go and get ourselves something to eat. You've been listening to another Broken Vessel Conversation with Dr. Dina Zoe Beluigi. Send feedback, comments, and ideas for interviews to me at d.beluigi@gmail.com.